Tonight we're here for the great book party of the new anthology, New Threats to Freedom. If you're interested in a copy, please let us know afterwards, and we've got several floating around. Please come on up. It's like a Gallagher show. There's going to be a lot of smashing of pumpkins, and we have ponchos. What we're going to do tonight is we're going to have the editor of the collection, Adam Bellow, talk about what the collection is about, how he put it together, and what he's hoping to achieve with it. And then we're going to have a series of contributors from the volume speak. Catherine Mangu Ward, an editor at Reason Magazine, who's written about the nanny state in her book and actually gave part of the subtitle in your essay, right, about ice cream being banned in Brooklyn. Of all places, Stephen Schwartz of the Weekly Standard. And Stephen, what is your think tank?
Center for Islamic Pluralism. I don't have an institutional affiliation with the Weekly Standard. Just a freelancer.
Okay. Just a freelancer. This is, that's a point of pride. Stephen wrote about Sharia law. And then we also have Christine Rosen, who is with the Ethics and Policy, Public Policy Center, or?
With the New Atlantis, which is published by the Ethics and Public Policy Center.
The New Atlantis is the journal of the EPPC, and you will be talking about the new determinists.
Behaviorists,
excuse me, who are determinists.
Yes.
Right. So, all right, so, okay. Okay, yeah, if everybody could turn off their cell phones. And before we turn it over to Adam, after everybody talks, then we'll have a spirited Q&A. And when you ask a question, I will ask you to actually ask a question and to keep it short and snarky if possible. And before we begin, I would like all of the contributors to the volume, could you please stand up if you're in the room? There's a number of people here, and we've been told that a lot of you have not even met each other. So you'll see that the enemy is... can I ask, can you introduce yourself and say what your contribution was?
Yes, Chris Norwood, and my contribution is the rise of mass dependency.
Thank you. I saw Greg Lukianoff in the background.
Greg Lukianoff, but Students Against Liberty.
One great thing about freedom is we're free to mispronounce. There are only mispronunciations. Who else is here?
Jessica Gavora, and I honestly can't remember what we called it. It's it should be, it's about single women and the threat they pose.
Single women and a threat that they pose to the male ego, as well as the super, okay, thank you.
My name is Tara McKelvey, and I wrote about the liberal abandonment of democracy promotion.
And that's a bad thing.
Yes.
Okay.
Ron Rosenbaum, and I wrote about the thuggishness enabled by cyber anonymity.
And who else do we have back here? Barry Lynn, Barry C. Lynn.
Barry C. Lynn, and I wrote a piece called Belief in False Gods, which was about sort of belief in metaphysical determinist powers.
Anybody else? All right, then we're going to start the show. Adam, turn your microphone on, and please tell us what New Threats to Freedom is all about.
Hi, is this working? Yes, okay. Well, thank you, for Nick, for hosting us. Welcome to everybody. Even those who did not contribute to our volume, I think there are a few people here who did not contribute essays. Although if I'd been allowed to continue, you all would be represented in the volume. I am a nonfiction book editor by trade. I work at HarperCollins in New York. I've been editing and publishing books primarily by conservatives for 20 years. This is the first time I've ever edited a collection of essays. I was asked to do so by Susan Ariano, the publisher of Templeton Press, which is a project of the Templeton Foundation. Susan and I are old colleagues and friends.
And Susan is here tonight.
And Susan is here tonight.
Give a wave of the hand, Susan.
Thank you for your largesse.
You will all be the next.
Yeah. Volume two. The beat goes on. There was no particular system or method to our procedure here. I simply began by reaching out to people whose books I had published, whose books I wished to publish, whose writing I admired. Periodically, Susan and I would have a conversation about what we had assembled. We talked about, you know, in a general way, trying to sort of cover a broad range of topics. But we understood that there would be many gaps, and that it would not be, an encyclopedic collection, including every threat that one could think of, and also not including every variety of thinker. We did try to represent a broad spectrum of opinion. Most of the contributors come from the center-right and libertarian nexus. There are also a number of liberals and leftists, because liberals care about freedom too, believe it or not. And I also went out of my way to invite a number of literary authors to contribute, including the novelist Mark Helprin, the playwright David Mamet, the critic Shelby Steele, who's someone I think of as having a sort of a literary sensibility. And this is because I particularly wanted that perspective, that broad, humane perspective that literary authors bring to bear on human affairs. I'm not sure how much more I need to say by way of introduction, except to say that when I finally sat down to read the collection myself, I was delighted by the liveliness, the variety, the intensely idiosyncratic nature of the voices that we had assembled. And this, it seemed to me, was precisely the sort of the spirit that we were looking for. We wanted to not just, you know, lecture people about threats to freedom, not just harp on the problem, but also to convey a sense of lively, spirited engagement with the intellectual effort and responsibility, really, of each individual person to think for themselves about what liberty is, what endangers it, and what we as individuals can do in our own lives and as citizens to preserve it.
Thank you, Adam. I want to thank Adam for introducing not just tonight's panel or set of topics, but also your piece is no small contribution to the essay collection as well. So thank you. And next up is Catherine Mangu Ward, who has 5 minutes to talk about a new threat to freedom. Thank you.
I'm not going to take the full 5 minutes, and I will let you be free to do whatever you want with the remaining couple. But those of you who know me know that I spend a lot of time thinking about food. I like to eat and consume things as a general matter. So my essay in the book uses the examples of ice cream, cigarettes, foie gras, donuts, I think, are in there. It's a pretty tasty little essay. And the idea is to make mountains out of molehills, to talk about how small incursions on liberty, small dents out of your sphere of freedom matter, and why they matter. So I'm just going to tell kind of a couple stories from my essay. The essay opens with the admittedly somewhat ridiculous and overblown comparison between the Taliban and yuppie Brooklyn moms. And the idea of that comparison is to point out this perhaps one important thing that they have in common, which is that they are annoyed by people who want to eat ice cream. So in Afghanistan pre-war, it was a crime to eat ice cream for women. This is partially because it's extremely awkward to eat ice cream in a burqa. The minute that you start to think about the mechanics of that, like all kinds of modesty is just immediately uprooted. So there was that sort of practical consideration, but the other was that it is this sort of decadent, Western, sinful activity, and that what the Taliban was seeking to do with the religious police there, was to protect people from themselves, to protect people from their worst selves. When you then cut forward to, as I was, you know, first thinking about this essay, when I was initially approached by Adam, there was a story in the New York Times about these Brooklyn moms who were calling 311, the complaint line, the city complaint line, on ice cream trucks in their parks. And it was because when the little jingly ice cream truck man came through with his happy little bell, their kids were whining because their kids wanted ice cream. And the moms didn't trust their kids to make good decisions, and rightly so. I mean, what four-year-old could make a good decision in the face of the Good Humor Man? But they also didn't trust themselves. They didn't want the responsibility of saying no to something that was bad for their kids. And so they wanted the state to enforce these zoning rules, which prohibit trucks from lingering once they've served clients that are already lined up at the curb. So the comparison here is just to say that there is this sense that the state should protect us from our worst selves in favor of our better selves. And that effort is often done in the name of being free, that we are less free when we have more choices. And I think that's a very powerful idea that remains current, that we have what Isaiah Berlin called our divided self, and that one of the sources of legitimacy of state power, or the place that people look to justify incursions of the state onto private behavior, is to favor the good self over the bad self. This also happens in New York in the case of taking trans fats out of foods, right? You say, or banning cigarettes. Obviously, the smoking bans are a perfect example of this. People making choices that are bad for them. And of course, the soft version of this, the soft paternalism or the libertarian paternalism idea, has also recently gotten a lot of currency. Cass Sunstein, who's now our regulatory czar, wrote a book with Richard Thaler called Nudge, in which he suggests taking the power of the state and being less overt about it, right? He's not talking about necessarily a direct ban, but he's still talking about sort of tweaking people's behavior in the direction of their better self. So basically, my essay is divided into consumables. As I said, we sort of move from ice cream to cigarettes to foie gras in Chicago, which is another parallel example. And the last section is pretty obviously about a cup of tea, right? And this is the revolutionary force behind people who are ticked off about these small incursions. And the rest of this book is full of great essays about really big, important ideas. You know, we're talking about Sharia, we're talking about, you know, world-shaping forces. And yet, I find, at least when I write about the little stuff, when I write about how your pastry is going to be slightly less flaky because they have to use a different kind of fat in it in New York City, or when you write about the slight inconvenience of having to drive across city limits to get your foie gras and brioche toast, weirdly, that's the thing that makes people angry. And the parallel here is both to the original Tea Party, which was ultimately about a tiny tax. It was about a small luxury tax. It was not about big things. It was just a symptom of big things. And then I think, you know, the other obvious parallel is to the new Tea Parties, which while they are, you know, the signs are about big issues, it is about nationalizing healthcare, it is about the size of government, it's also about the little stuff. It's about people feeling less free because of these small incursions on their liberty. And I guess I would just close up by urging you all to strike a blow for liberty and go eat something that's terrible for you today, or I guess as might be more appropriate in this event, drink something that's terrible for you once this panel is over.
Thank you, Pastor. Thanks. And now, Stephen Schwartz.
Well, as one of America's probably most famous and or infamous people who chose Islam, I don't say convert because I didn't have a religion before, but as a Muslim and a Sufi and as a scholar of Islam, I want to say, first of all, Catherine, the daylight between banning ice cream in Brooklyn or attempting to ban ice cream in Brooklyn and the Taliban, There's really almost no daylight there at all. It's really, in my view, it's the same phenomenon, and it's one of the great paradoxes and challenges of Islamic thought and Islamic history, is that the fundamentalist instinct in Islam, which basically says that moral rules have to be imposed upon people through beatings, through a morals militia, et cetera, is a new phenomenon in Islam. It's only about 250 years old. One of the traditional criticisms of Islam was that it was morally lax and fatalistic, and essentially allowed everybody to do whatever they wanted to do to a certain extent on the presumption that God alone would finally judge them. It's a fascinating reality that all of these tendencies toward the limitation of individual choice, individual responsibility, and individual morality are recent. So, as I say, Islamic fundamentalism and the fascination with attempting to impose Sharia, reimpose Sharia as public law, these are new phenomena in Islam. One of the probably the greatest Islamic philosopher, Al-Ghazali, said that a Muslim who is obsessed with the Sharia on the presumption that it will bring him closer to God is frankly insane. That's classic Islam. That's classic Islam. I'm not going to go into a long discussion of that, but I'm just going to now describe the essay I wrote for Adam. And thank you very much, Adam, for including me in such august company. It really was very gratifying for me. My organization, the Center for Islamic Pluralism, received a grant to study the penetration of Sharia agitation, that is, agitation for Sharia as public law, in five Western European countries: Britain, Holland, France, Spain, and Germany. What we found was that overwhelmingly, the Muslims living in those countries did not want Sharia law. They did not want Sharia law imposed upon them. They did not want Sharia law introduced into the West. And another aspect of traditional Islam is Sharia law is supposed to exist only in Muslim societies. It cannot be introduced into a non-Muslim society. What we've seen in the last, especially since the Khomeini Revolution in Iran, with the rise of this agitation for Sharia in the West, and in regard to my group's study and in general, the country with the biggest problem in this regard is England. England is about 70%. England's Muslims are about 70% anti-Sharia, that is, anti-imposition of Sharia as public law, and about 30% will say they're for it, even though they don't really know very much about it. It isn't really, there isn't much pro-Sharia agitation in the other four countries. The center of this conflict is really in England, and it's in the Pakistani South Asian Muslim community in England. But we found three very interesting things, and they're reflected in my essay in the book. First, most of the Muslims living in Western Europe don't want the imposition of Sharia as public law in Western Europe. Secondly, however, a considerable number of non-Muslim public figures, such as the Archbishop of Canterbury, Lord Worth Maltravers of the British Supreme Court, a German politician, a Dutch politician, conservative, various other people, various local authorities in France, will say Sharia would be acceptable to us. In other words, they're offering to the Muslims something the Muslims haven't asked for. This is an expression of political correctness, an expression of trying to be nice to the Muslims by giving them something that, frankly, as one of our Muslim informants said, the Archbishop of Canterbury doesn't know what Sharia is. Most Muslims in England don't know what Sharia is. The whole thing is a meaningless discussion. It has, however, caused a great deal of anxiety, especially in England, because Sharia, which in its personal form is limited to things like diet, the way you pray, how the dead are buried, male circumcision, and payment of charity, which doesn't interfere with anybody else, Sharia is viewed in the West largely in terms of what we call in Islam hudud punishments, the cutting of hands, the stoning of alleged or proven adulteresses or adulterers, etc. So my point in the essay was to explain that, first of all, most Muslims in the West are in the West because they don't want to live under fundamentalist Islam. That's why they came to the West. It's one of the reasons they came to the West, aside from economic motivations. But secondly, there is another and much more serious and much more sinister phenomenon, which is what we call parallel Sharia. And this is a movement developed by the Swiss Muslim intellectual Tariq Ramadan, recently welcomed with great applause and fervor and love by the Obama administration to Washington. A school of thought developed by Tariq Ramadan, by the Qatari fundamentalist cleric Yusuf Qaradawi, who also supports terrorism and also supports female genital mutilation, and by another Muslim cleric who you won't have heard of, but who lived in the United States for a long time. And their formulation was that Sharia could be introduced into the West, that is, in defiance of the traditional Islamic law, Sharia could be introduced to the West as a legal canon applicable to Muslims under the umbrella of diversity, political correctness, equal rights, et cetera, et cetera. That is, the Muslims living in the West would be subject to Sharia, not the non-Muslims, but the Muslims. This is a very real threat to freedom. And it's a threat to the freedom of the Muslims first, because the Muslims don't want this. But secondly, it's a threat to the freedom of everybody living in these Western societies, because very clearly, when the rights of citizens or subjects of a Western society are diluted in this way, it's a slippery slope. And when you start by saying, well, we'll set up a separate legal system for Muslims living in England through, in some cases, mediation tribunals, et cetera, et cetera, there's no end to it. I mean, I don't have to tell the people in this room that. There's no end to it. So we, as traditional and moderate Muslims, we are opposed to any invasion of Sharia as public law in the West. We defend the personal Sharia of diet, prayer, burial, charity, and male circumcision. That's a matter of personal habit. It's nobody else's business but ours. But we are opposed to any invasion of Sharia as public law into the West. And especially, we are opposed to an invasion of Sharia imposed upon Muslims as an expression of political correctness, pseudo-diversity. And I think I've explained it pretty well there. Thank you.
Thank you.
I got this one.
Oh, and now Christine Rice, talking about the new behaviorists.
Well, I first of all want to thank Adam for including me in this collection. I really urge everyone to read it. If you disagree even with the three of us, you'll still find a handful of six, you know, 10 people in the collection that you will agree with, and some who are even having interesting cross arguments about things like the role of Islam in Western civilization. I'm going to pick up on Catherine's essay, and she masterfully combined both Islam and ice cream and behavioral science in her opening remarks. So I want to pick up on the ice cream truck that grows in Brooklyn, we hope, and bring it here to inside the Beltway. And as she mentioned, there are a lot of regulatory efforts being made now by the Obama administration, who I think we really could call our first behaviorist in chief as president. Anyone who's heard the word Freakonomics, which if you have been alive in the last 5 years, you've heard, or predictably irrational, or any of the number of popularizations of behavioral economics in recent years, you know it's a very interesting idea. It gets a lot of play. It's now getting a lot of policy heft, and it's getting the support of the administration behind it. So what is this idea? It seems really kind of intriguing, doesn't it? Because one of the things that it tells us is if you're unhealthy, fat, and have a very low balance in your savings account, it's probably not entirely your fault. Pizza Hut lards its pizza with salt and trans fats and makes you crave it. You're like a rat on, you know, searching for cheese. It's such a complicated thing to save for retirement, and the 401k plans are so baffling that really, if we only had an easier choice, we would do better. And so on and so on. So what I would urge everyone to think about, and what my essay did, is to first ask, is this a new thing in American history? Absolutely not. We've had waves of enthusiasm for behavioral science. We saw it at the early 20th century with James B. Watson, who was a psychologist, who ended up, predictably enough, on Madison Avenue. And if any of you watch Mad Men, you will see his work fictionalized in Mad Men. This was the beginning of the hidden persuaders, the effort to kind of use the lab, the laboratory, what we learn in psychology, and apply it to market products. Another wave came through with B.F. Skinner, who a very famous behavioral scientist, mid-century, who had a huge impact on self-help. There was everyone wanted to get thinner with Skinner. There were all these efforts to control your behavior if you just had the right techniques. Because the thing about behavioral science and the thing about our current behavioral economists is that it's such a nice idea to say, you know, it's not genetic determinism. It's just your environment. You either don't have enough information to make these decisions, so an expert elite who knows that you're predictably irrational, knows that you're going to shove that fourth piece of pizza in your maw even though you know it's bad for you, will instead limit your choices and in this give you a new kind of freedom. So the second half of my essay question, what is this freedom? And it really is freedom from certain types of behaviors that we know objectively might harm us down the road. It's also a freedom to be a certain kind of American citizen. Thin, wealthy, productive, I assume, you know, shops at Whole Foods if possible. I mean, you know, a certain kind of Mandarin class, self-control elite citizen. And there are lots of great people who fit all those descriptions. However, that's not true liberty. That's not true freedom. If you want to smoke two packs a day of cigarettes, you're willing to take that risk. You likely know the long-term consequences. So I guess I would say the danger of the behavioral economics worldview is that it poses as a kind of libertarian paternalism. It's trying to co-opt a term that it really doesn't have any evidence for or standing to use. It also is trying to, I think it has a deeply pessimistic view of human nature. Because in the end it's saying, we're all a little bit too easily led. We're all a bunch of sheeple who'll follow the next trend. And we don't really have enough fortitude, enough individual virtue or character to make these complicated choices for ourselves. And so I would say Catherine's essay is well worth reading for these specific examples of how this is played out in particular with food. The political philosophy behind it, though, is also, it is a real threat to the future of freedom in this country, because I think it will encourage people to give up, for the sake of convenience, the difficult choices that we all have to face as citizens. And every time we allow the government to limit the options from 50 to 3, because it'll be much easier for us, we are making a choice against freedom. So that's all I would say about that.
Thank you very much.